This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Everyone agrees in hindsight that the mortgage crisis was the fault of big banks and shady lenders. But no individual or corporation has actually paid a serious price or been held responsible. While the U.S. economy has yet to emerge from the Great Recession of 2008, triggered by the mortgage crisis, Wall Street corporations seem to be doing just fine. The rest of us, not so much, especially those among us who struggled with underwater mortgages and those who lost their homes to foreclosure. Now, a new book attempts to rewrite the history of the mortgage crisis through the eyes of three ordinary Americans who refuse to accept the status quo. My guest, David Dayan, tells the stories of Lisa Epstein, Michael Redman, and Lynn Simoniak in his acclaimed new book, Chain of Title. David Dayan is a contributor to The Salon and The Intercept, a weekly columnist for The Fiscal Times and The New Republic. And the full title of his book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Welcome back to the show, David. I should say you're a frequent guest on this program. We're so happy to have you back on.
Thank you for having me on. Thanks for your interest in this book.
How did all of this get started? How did you identify these three individuals of the thousands of Americans who fought their foreclosures, who struggled with their foreclosures? How did these, or why did these three individuals stand out to you in terms of how they dealt with what happened to them?
Well, these three really remarkable individuals, first of all, they committed sort of a revolutionary act by actually reading their mortgage documents when they got them in the mail, and realizing that there were these huge irregularities. And they became obsessed with building a coalition to really get the word out about the fact that these documents that were put in to courts to prove that mortgage companies owned these loans and could foreclose on people were fake, that they were false evidence. And these three built their own websites to sort of get the word out about that and post their research. And that's how I stumbled upon them. When I was reporting on the foreclosure crisis in 2009, 2010, I kept going back to their websites because they were so interesting. And only after knowing them for a little while did I realize they were foreclosure victims themselves who had done more investigation than any journalist, than the state or federal government, really. And that their stories were really worth telling.
So let's start with Lisa Epstein, who you start with in your book. She is a mother at the time of the story. She was married, or she was going to get married, but she found her own place, and she and her husband bought a place to live in. And she, just like thousands of Americans, suddenly found herself at the center of this crisis. But she actually, as you said, sort of educated herself amazingly and spent many long nights doing so. Tell us a little bit of her story. What motivated her?
Yeah, so Lisa Epstein is she was a cancer nurse. And I think she was just motivated by just wanting to understand at a basic level what was going on to her and what was going on in the economy. When she received her foreclosure papers, the entity that was foreclosing on her was called U.S. Bank. And U.S. Bank doesn't exist in Florida. She had never paid them a dime in a mortgage payment. She didn't know who they were. And it was that triggered the discovery that she had of the fact that the documents were something was very irregular about them, and the person that was trying to foreclose on her had no real right to do so. And so she, as you said, became obsessed, and she calls it her sleepless phase, where she slept only 3 hours a night for about 3 years, using the rest of that time to really study and research and become self-taught in the mortgage industry. She had no interest or understanding of high finance or mortgages, real estate law whatsoever, until She was thrust into this crisis, and then she really got an education.
And meanwhile, her child was struggling with a health issue. And as any parent who's had a child in that situation knows, that generally consumes your every waking moment.
Yeah, her daughter was born with a form of spina bifida. This was part of the struggle that led her to foreclosure. Her husband also lost his job, and they moved at exactly the wrong time. She got a new home at the same time that a condo that she had could not be sold because we were right in the middle of the crisis. So all of those factors led her into this foreclosure trap. Her mortgage company told her that they don't handle modifying and helping, giving relief to any individual until they miss three payments. And she had never missed a payment on anything in her life. Her credit score was 800. And she missed these payments and said to the bank, okay, you told me to miss payments. Now I'm looking for some help. And they came out and foreclosed on her. So that really starts the story, and you move through this process. And just as she became obsessed with fighting her own foreclosure case, she decided that others needed help too. And she really worked to build a space so that people could come and learn more about this issue and get resources to help themselves.
And the title of your book, Chain of Title, is really an important aspect of the story, which is that this particular industry, financial industry in our country, has become so complex, so utterly like abstract, if you will, where the bank that you think that you actually owe money to, practically before the ink dries on your loan papers, has turned around and sold bundled your mortgage with thousands of other mortgages, sold it to another bank that might have sold it to another bank. And how much of a part of the problem of trying to solve the crisis was this built-in complication?
That was all of the problem. I mean, what you're describing is really the kind of thing that we saw in The Big Short, that these mortgage companies would sell your loan to an investment bank, they would sell it several other times, and then pass it on in mortgage-backed securities. They would bundle thousands of loans and make these bonds out of them and sell them all around the world. The problem is that in that process, they forgot one very crucial thing, which is to ensure the proper transfer of those mortgages so that there is a chain of title, a chain of ownership from one entity to the other. And they simply neglected to do that. And if they would have done that, we would have had a smaller housing bubble because it just would have been much more costly, much more time consuming to actually do the proper transfers that's well settled in property law that has been in effect in this country since the 1630s. The fact that they didn't do that enabled them to engage in this massive financialization where they would, sell millions of loans and throw them all over the world in securities. The problem was that when people started to default, the banks needed the ability to prove that they own the loans in order to foreclose on it. Just like if I accused you of stealing my car, I would have to come up with a piece of paper showing that I actually own the car at some level in order to get a favorable judgment on that. So in order to rectify that, what the banks did is they decided to fudge the documents.
Right.
They created fake paper. Fake mortgage assignments saying that they acquired this mortgage well after the cutoff date where they were able to do that. The documents that were sent into these courts were backdated, they were forged, they were fabricated, they were clearly fraudulent, and they were used to kick people out of their homes.
Now, did that just happen to Lisa Epstein and the people you profile in your book, or was this essentially the standard by which banks foreclosed on thousands of people after the mortgage crisis?
Yes, this was a systemic practice. You're talking about millions of loans, practically every loan that was securitized was done in this fashion using false documents in order to prove standing to foreclose.
So widespread fraud took place. How many people, aside from Lisa Epstein, were able to go to court and say, no, this was forged, this is a false signature, the bank can't foreclose on my home because it can't prove that it owns the mortgage to my home?
Right. Very few people actually challenge their foreclosures. Maybe 95% of foreclosure cases go uncontested. Mm-hmm. There were some cases that wound its way through, and those became more widespread after Lisa and Michael and Lynn started posting all of this information about false documents and attracted a real following of people who were mired in this, who got educated by their websites and their information that they displayed publicly for all to see, to the point that at the end of 2010, because they had amassed so much evidence that what was going on was fraudulent, the leading mortgage companies in America all stopped foreclosing on people because they could no longer do it legally. Unfortunately, that was just a pause, but it shows the power of what Lisa, Michael, and Lynn were able to do using only the internet and the truth. They brought the mortgage industry to its knees for a time.
Okay, so Lisa Epstein then met Michael Redman. Let's bring up Michael's story. Michael was insurance fraud.
He was
a car salesman, right? Tell us about who Michael was and how similar his story was to Lisa Epstein.
Yeah, his story was very similar, actually. The difference being that he got a loan for a home, and 2 years into, after he was making all the payments, he was told by his mortgage company that they had miscalculated the escrow on his home and his mortgage payment was going to go up by 35%.
Wow.
Now, if it wasn't at that number to begin with, he would never have bought the loan. But because it was after the fact and they were asking for all back money to pay for all that, he could no longer afford it. And so he fell into foreclosure. And what he found was his loan, the servicer of it was a company named Washington Mutual, which went out of business, was acquired by J.P. Morgan Chase. And he found J.P. Morgan Chase employees assigning the mortgage to themselves on behalf of another company. And this was incredibly distressing to him. And he started digging through the public records. They did massive public record searches, most of them on the internet. And he came up with a guide to how to search for fraud in the public records. It became very popular. He was invited to a conference to speak about it in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And he ended up meeting Lisa Epstein at that conference. And they got together and they really made a pact that they were going to expose this to the nation, that they were going to get this in front of as many people as humanly possible in the order to get a reasonable solution for homeowners and to punish those who were responsible for the wrongdoing.
Mm. Now, so what happened to Michael Redman? Was it just a clerical error that there was a miscalculation in how much he owed for his monthly mortgage? Or was this the kind of balloon mortgage that many people found themselves sort of not realizing they had signed up for, that, you know, for the first few years they would be paying a lower amount and all of a sudden their monthly payment would jump?
It's a bit unclear, but there's no question that there were these debt traps that went on during the origination of mortgages during the housing bubble, where people thought they were going to pay a certain price, and then all of a sudden they'd be paying one that was much, much higher. A lot of that information was kept from people as the proper disclosures were not made. There were these massive resets that mortgage lenders told borrowers, don't worry about it, you can always refinance out of trouble. And the problem is that once we hit the top of the bubble and it peaked, nobody could refinance anymore because the prices started falling and falling and falling. And so Michael experienced a situation that many, many people experienced, where through no fault of their own, suddenly they owed much more on their homes than they thought they had agreed to.
And then Lisa Epstein and Michael Redman, the two characters we've met so far of the three-year profile, they met Lynn Simoniak. Who is Lynn?
So Lynn was actually a white-collar crime expert. She was really focused on insurance fraud and workers' compensation fraud. She was a lawyer. So you could say that the banks foreclosed on the wrong person when they foreclosed on her. The foreclosure arose out of a disagreement. She had a loan where the interest rate was supposed to reset at a certain time. The bank passed that deadline, but then reset the interest rate anyway. So it was a dispute over the contract. And she decided to stop payments to try to gain leverage over this, and they threw her into foreclosure. One thing she found on her mortgage documents is that one of the witnesses on her mortgage assignment, on the date that the assignment was supposed to be executed, this individual, Carell Harp, was actually in state prison in Oklahoma. So there was no way that he could have actually signed that document. Interestingly, he was in state prison for identity theft, even though his identity was being stolen to be used in forged documents. What she ended up finding out was that there were these corporate resolutions that banks gave to these third-party companies that manufactured the documents, and they had individual people who were allowed to sign on behalf of that corporation. However, in order to speed up the assembly line, the third-party companies would have multiple people sign on behalf of that name. So you had a situation where someone like Linda Green, who was listed as a vice president of 20 different banks, had her name signed by 15 different people at this particular company. So you could go to the public records and see Linda Green's name with 15 different styles of handwriting.
Wow.
Clearly forged documents, and they were submitted to courts and used to evict people from their homes.
I should mention, by the way, that all three of these people and this entire story is set in the state of Florida. There were several sort of epicenters of the mortgage crisis, and Florida was one of them. How did sort of Florida stand out in the country? Why did it become this stronghold of foreclosure fraud cases, if you will?
Yeah. So there were really four states that were the most hard hit by the crisis: Florida, California, Arizona, and Nevada. Those are known as the sand states. And one half of all subprime mortgages originated in the peak year 2006 came from those four states. The difference is, in Florida, you actually need judicial sign off for a foreclosure. A judge has to make a ruling and a judgment in favor of the bank. That's not true in California, Arizona, and Nevada. Those are non-judicial foreclosure states where you can just post a notice of default and go through a certain process and the bank can get the foreclosure done. So because in Florida you had to go into a court, the documents that were used fraudulently to foreclose were much more readily available. They were in these public court cases. And so it was much easier to see, because people would, victims, defendants in these foreclosure cases would get the documents directly to their homes and they could see the fraud therein. And so that's why Florida became the epicenter of fighting foreclosure fraud.
So, David, let's talk about how these three people then essentially did what all of the journalists and experts and lawmakers and policymakers and, you know, judges failed to do. I mean, is it that, you know, their personal experience, this was their life, this was their own personal story that motivated them, and so they dug so much deeper than legions of people who really should have dug deeper did? I mean, is that what happened, that they found out things that others failed to find out?
That's correct. They did a massive amount of investigation, looking through the public records. Lisa Epstein spent so much time at the Palm Beach County Courthouse that she started getting mail there. That's how often she could be found there. It was just about a mile from where she worked at the hospital, and she would run there every day on her lunch hour, just searching for more information and more answers. And then when they put up their own websites, that information was distributed to everyone all around the country. And they started doing projects with other lawyers and other activists in other states, and really amassing a body of evidence that showed that millions of these foreclosures were inherently fraudulent because the documentation used in the foreclosure case was fake. And so they ended up delivering this information to law enforcement, whether at the state level or at the federal level. They would customize bundles of documents for each state saying, okay, here's Illinois, here's 50 documents of fraudulent foreclosures in Illinois, here's 50 in New York, and here's 50 in Hawaii. And they would send them to the authorities. The problem was that nobody really wanted to listen until the banks admitted their mistake and stopped foreclosing at the end of 2010. And even then, there wasn't the kind of follow-up that you would have expected when you're talking about the largest consumer fraud in American history, with millions of homes being foreclosed on based on falsehoods.
And so we had this sort of David versus Goliath story with these, you know, three ordinary Americans being David and this giant Goliath, and sort of an Aaron Brockovich style story. You tell the story in a way that unfolds very naturally, and I don't want to give it away for people who want to read your book Chain of Title, but let's at least ask the question finally of has anyone ever been held accountable, and will anyone, perhaps after your book, now that your book is out, you think be held accountable? Are there any processes in motion anywhere legally to hold the banks and the fraudsters, the people who forged the signatures, accountable?
Well, Sonali, I don't think I'm giving anything away to tell you that there wasn't a whole lot of consequences for any of this. Sadly enough, Wall Street and Washington got together and made sure that any consequences would be limited. There were some cash settlements that really were designed to create these big headline numbers that weren't the actual reality of the situation. There were no criminal subpoenas. There was one very large criminal investigation that ended in the conviction of exactly one person. Her name was Lorraine Brown. She worked for a company called DocX, one of these third parties that actually manufactured the documents. But amazingly, she was convicted of duping the banks rather than acting in partnership with them to give them the evidence they needed in these foreclosure cases. So I would say that Lynn, Michael, and Lisa are fairly disillusioned with the system at this point. The sad fact remains that every day in America, somebody continues to be thrown out of their home based on false documents. The activity did not stop with these settlements. And there's every ability for any law enforcement official in this nation to open new cases based on that. I don't have a lot of faith that they will. But yet, I wrote this book because I wanted to recognize the contribution that was made and show that there really was an alternative. We could have gotten the accountability that so much of us really have yearned for. It's part of such of the anxiety and frustration that we've seen in our politics and in the election cycle. This idea that nobody went to jail for the kinds of misconduct during the financial crisis is this just sort of nagging frustration within the system. It engenders this loss of faith in institutions. And until we get our arms around that, until the institutions in this country that have the ability to enforce the law actually start doing so, we're still going to experience that nagging sense of anger.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for all the work that you do on a daily basis and this book. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
David Dayan is a contributor to The Salon and The Intercept, a weekly columnist for The Fiscal Times and The New Republic. His new book is called Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.